This year, 2010, the Chautauqua Institution celebrates its 137th season with a mission to inspire the best in human values. Each summer, Chautauqua presents 9 weeks of artistic, educational, and religious programming. Our four pillars of art, education, religion, and recreation make Chautauqua a singular experience beyond description. The talk you are about to hear is part of a program that records the famous Chautauqua Morning Lecture, the afternoon lectures at the Hall of Philosophy, sponsored by the Department of Religion, the exceptional Sunday morning worship services at the amphitheater, and other special events. We take you now to Chautauqua, where today's program is about to begin.
Good afternoon, of missions. And now it is my pleasure to welcome to the platform and to say another few words to you about Jonathan Granoff. You've heard Jonathan Granoff before. Jonathan helped us put this week together. So I'm hoping, Jonathan, that you take some pride in the fact that the week that you helped put together and the people that you helped identify for speakers have really brought to Chautauqua the beginnings of a new social movement. And I thank you personally for that very, very much. Jonathan is the president of the Global Security Institute, a nonprofit organization committed to the elimination of nuclear weapons, and also the co-creator of This Week on Nuclear Disarmament. I could read you Jonathan's bio, which most of you by now have heard before or have seen in the paper, so instead I will say a couple of personal words. I have known Jonathan Granoff for probably 10 to 15 years, if not more. And I have known him always to be passionate, sometimes passionate enough to wear you out slightly, but passionate in a good way about this issue and about a host of other issues that make a difference in our society. And this morning I did a podcast with Jonathan, which you'll be able to hear on the website. And I think one of the issues that I most admire about Jonathan Granoff is not this long list of accomplishments and the people that he's met and the encounters that he's had in relation to world peace and disarmament, but it is his capacity of staying power. For many people, once they get an issue, if things don't go right and if there's discouragement, they tend to give up and go on to something else. That is not a description of Jonathan Granoff. Jonathan Granoff gets hold of an issue, an important issue, an issue that's crucial to our common future, and he doesn't give up on that issue, and he continues to delve more deeply into it and to speak to however large, however small, however far away a crowd that will hear what he has to say and the passion that he brings to this very crucial issue. Let me also say, before bringing Jonathan to the platform, that we want to express our grateful thanks to the Reverend Dr. Ralph Lowe Religious Lectureship. For those of you who are longtime Chautauquans, you know that Ralph Lowe was the director of the Department of Religion. I believe it was three directors ago, so I stand in the shadow of someone like Ralph Lowe. He's a treasured former director, and we continue to honor his memory as we are grateful for the continuing blessing that his endowment provides for us. Please join me in thanking his family, and if they are seated with us, Janet and Mike Day, would you stand that we might thank you? Thank you so very, very much. And I will say that it was not an accident that this is the particular lecture that you are sponsoring, given who you are and what your lives have been about. So, Jonathan, it is yours.
Fact is, I'm a Reverend Joan Campbell groupie. And the reason is that her mission is bringing the heart of love that is the central message of the gospel, and at least in my opinion. It's a message of embrace, it's a message of unity, it's not a message of wedge politics. And she has used that heart of love as a message of unity and embrace to address the terrible divide of racism that is a cancer in a state of being cured in our country now, with a black man as president that we can be proud of. And she is also one of the most important people who has broken the barrier of gender in the clergy. And she, her gift, I believe, and one of the reasons she's been so successful, is her ability to bring out the best in other people without confronting us, by encouraging and amplifying that which is most virtuous in all of us. And to have her as the minister, you know, in really the minister in Chautauqua because of this religious program is really quite a blessing. And it is totally appropriate that Chautauqua be identified as a place for a new movement. Now, it's not new, a movement to abolish nuclear weapons. There were people trying to abolish nuclear weapons from the very beginning of the nuclear venture. In fact, even before the first test at Alamogordo in the Valley of Death, Joseph Rotblat walked off. He won a Nobel Peace Prize in 1995 for it. He walked off and said, don't build the weapon. He said, don't build the weapon. Because if you build it, you will use it. Others will get it. Others will use it and will be on a catastrophic course. But what might be new, might be the convergence of the moral imperative with the practical necessity. I disagreed with the king last night in the play. That play was great. But what I disagreed with was when he said there were too many notes. I like a lot of notes. I like a lot of different approaches to an issue. I liked the fact that we heard two fabulous presentations by my colleague Joe Cerencione on the security issues and the political issues that compel us to move forward on a disarmament agenda, that compel us to move forward to get our politicians to take the next very small step of ratifying the START Treaty. I like that approach is absolutely essential. It cannot be neglected. But I believe that the most important note in an orchestra, the most important instrument, is the tuning fork. For without the tuning fork, it's cacophony. And the tuning fork for me in any issue of social policy has to be the moral and ethical foundation. That has to be the clarity. Without that clarity of moral purpose, you can end up with improved means to unimproved ends. And if ever there was a venture that exemplified that, it is nuclear weapons. Since the why of nuclear weapons is the pursuit of security, that's the why, ostensibly. The how is the huge arsenals. They're no longer fulfilling the why. There's an argument that they may have been fulfilling the why during the Cold War. They might have been a necessary evil. May have been, but now they're just evil. The most important note in any social venture is the moral and ethical. Otherwise, we end up with the sort of situation of Alice in Wonderland when she comes to the Cheshire Cat. You know, and the Cheshire Cat says, how can I help you? And she says, I don't know which road to take. And he says, where are you trying to get to? She says, I don't know. He says, then it doesn't matter. And if we don't know that we're trying to get to a world without nuclear weapons, a world in which we are not threatening to annihilate all life on the planet Earth, a world in which we are not pursuing security by threatening to kill hundreds of millions of innocent people, if we don't know that that's our goal, then the compass point can keep shifting in terms of the crisis du jour, the national security narrative of one president or another, the vicissitudes of history and politics. For me, the idea that we would put all life on the planet at risk is highly problematic. After 30 years fighting for the abolition of nuclear weapons, I've come to realize that when talking about nuclear weapons, it's all too easy to overlook the human dimension. My oldest son came to me one night 16 years ago and said, "Dad, I'm going to Japan." He was about 16 at the time. I said, "Oh, who's paying for it?" He said, "The American Friends Service Committee. I'm going with a group of American teenagers, and we're going to interview survivors." He went, and he spent the summer in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When he came back, I asked him, "What did you learn?" And he said, "I learned one thing, Dad. You know, on Mom's side, we're Armenian, and that part of our family suffered a genocide. On your side, we're Jewish, and that part of our family also suffered a genocide. But I really didn't grasp it until I went there. Now what has hit me is that to kill massive numbers of innocent people, you first have to dehumanize them. And we can no longer afford to dehumanize anybody on the planet Earth. Whatever political system is operating in any country, what is most important is whether its policy makers exercise human compassion or not." I said, "Son, I'm now your colleague. I'm not your teacher. I've not come much farther than this insight, and I'm still learning about it, and we can learn together." General Lee Butler, who was in charge of the entire arsenal, created the single integrated operating plan, said, "Accepting nuclear weapons as the ultimate arbiter of conflict condemns the world to live under a dark cloud of perpetual anxiety. Worse, it codifies mankind's most murderous instincts as an acceptable resort when other options for resolving conflict fail. I've spent years studying nuclear weapons effects, have investigated a distressing array of accidents, some of which you heard this morning, and incidents involving strategic weapons and forces. I came away from that experience deeply troubled by what I see as the burden of building and maintaining these arsenals, the daily operational risks, the constant prospect of a crisis that will hold entire societies at risk." The daily prospect. I had the privilege of interviewing Stanislav Petrov. Stanislav Petrov was the colonel in charge of watching the then Soviet arsenal. One evening, they had a bunch of computer screens, and he was watching, and it looked like there was a full-scale American launch. And he knew that if he passed this information up the command and control, that they wouldn't have enough time really to say no, because the weapons were on a use them or lose them basis. Because the first volley in a nuclear exchange is ostensibly aimed at your adversary's weapons. So he didn't tell anybody. And he saved the world. There will be a documentary coming out on that in the next year called "The Man Who Saved the World." So I asked him, "How did you have the courage and the humility not to follow your protocols?" And he said there were two reasons. One reason is I was a computer engineer, and I knew that computers make mistakes. The other reason is God told me he didn't want the world to end. So then he said, and when they evaluated my conduct to determine whether to reward me for saving the world or punish me, the biggest problem that my superiors had was I believed in God. God didn't want me to end the world. George Kennan, not usually known as a voice of moral imperatives, said, and I quote, "The readiness to use nuclear weapons against other human beings, against people we do not know, whom we've never seen, and whose guilt or innocence is not for us to establish, and in so doing, place in jeopardy the natural structure upon which all civilization rests, as though the safety and perceived interests of our own generation were more important than everything that has taken place or could take place in civilization, this is nothing less than a presumption, a blasphemy, an indignity, an indignity of monstrous dimensions offered to God. That's George Kennan. So you have military leaders, economists, ethicists, condemning this as a moral horror. And what do we have going on today? At the historic Security Council summit that took place in September, that our president, and we can be proud of this, convened. It's the first time a United States president ever chaired a Security Council summit. First time. The president of Costa Rica pointed out that every night as we sleep, over 22,000 eyes of death continue to peer out upon us. There are still over 22,000 nuclear weapons in the world. And the arsenals between the United States and Russia still remain on launch on warning alert status. In other words, our government, as we sit here, is allowing thousands of nuclear warheads to be pointed at us. I don't find that acceptable. I don't find it acceptable that this is not a national priority to immediately address that these nuclear weapons are pointed at us. And we're not talking about Hiroshima-sized devices. We're talking about weapons that are 20, 30 times the size of the destructive capacity of Hiroshima. And we're not talking about hundreds. We're talking about thousands. The START Treaty is so important, it'll only bring it down to 1,500, which is enough still to end civilization many times over. But it's a step. It seems to me beyond any level of morality or reason that people wouldn't want to take that step. It seems to me beyond any kind of reason that once you know this, that you would be silent about it. Because the reason why these weapons are pointed at us is that we have a similar number pointed at them. And I don't really believe that normal Americans want to wipe out Russians. In fact, I bought my gasoline a few days ago from a Russian concession. And the money that I used to buy it with was backed by a loan from China. Half the stuff in my house was made in China. Why are we doing this? Why is this continuing to happen? Are we somehow responsible for allowing this to continue to happen? Is our silence to be taken as assent? Do we agree with this? I want to try and put a little human face on this. In 1995, there were two major law cases on the planet Earth. One of them had the largest public audience in the history, probably of any trial in human history, O.J. Simpson. There was another case going on at the same time that had more nations and the best lawyers on the planet Earth, more nations than in any other case ever argued before the International Court of Justice, in which the court addressed the legality of the use or threat of nuclear weapons. And that probably had less people watching it than a local divorce action of a football player in Buffalo. Probably one of the most important legal debates ever in human history. Whether or not it is legal to threaten or to use nuclear weapons, the International Court of Justice ruled unanimously that there is a legal duty to negotiate to completion the universal, legally verifiable elimination of nuclear weapons. And how many of you here knew about that decision? One, And this is after a week of experts. And law has to be one of the reins that we use to pull in this horse of technology. Yes, we have to have policy positions. Yes, we need to have the admonition of our generals. But we need law. And law has to mean something, because we're a country founded on law. So the International Court of Justice ruled unanimously that there is a legal duty to negotiate to completion. But the irony was that because law is not perfect, they couldn't rule that in all instances you couldn't use the weapon pending the negotiation of abolition, because the nation state is the primary institutional framework of international law. And they couldn't rule that in an exigent circumstance, a nuclear weapon couldn't be used to save the very existence of the state. But then they were pondering, this is so weird, because to save the state, you could end civilization. And that's why they said, to come around this conundrum, we decide unanimously on the duty to negotiate elimination. The reason why they had this problem is the lawyers of the United Kingdom and the United States argued, well, what if there was a depth charge dropped in the high Atlantic? That wouldn't violate humanitarian law. Or what if we dropped one in the Gobi Desert to take out some troops? That would be okay. They were reaching to justify the weapons, because that's not what the weapons are about. That's not why they're there. That's not where they're pointed. That's not how they're used. They are weapons of terror, and deterrence comes from the word with terror. They are designed to terrify. They are designed to kill in proportions beyond human imagination. A 1 megaton bomb, according to Judge Wiramontri in the decision from the testimony, he said it, the imagination can't grasp it, but he said, imagine a train stretching from Los Angeles to New York filled with TNT, because a 1 megaton bomb represents 80 Hiroshimas. It's hard to imagine. 80 Hiroshimas is a 1 megaton bomb. Now, the Soviets tested a 50 megaton bomb once. So that's what we can build these weapons, although we don't have any in that range because it's silly. How many times do you have to blow up the world? The court said also that any use would have to comply with international humanitarian law. And international humanitarian law prohibits the use of weapons of indiscriminate effect. It prohibits the use of weapons of unnecessary suffering, like dum-dum bullets. It prohibits the use of weapons that will affect future generations or commit environmental catastrophe. And so the court said, we can hardly imagine any use of these weapons that would comply with international humanitarian law. The very, very good news that I want to share with you is that in May of this year, 189 countries came together at the United Nations and unanimously agreed for the first time that any use of a nuclear weapon would have to comply with international humanitarian law. This just took place in May. So the organization that I'm the president of, the Global Security Institute, we're going to have a conference in September in Geneva, hosted by the Swiss government. And part of our agenda will be, what are the implications of this? But we will have 25 diplomats of middle power countries, countries that have forsaken nuclear weapons, that are capable of building nuclear weapons, and that have to be listened to. Countries that depend on the rule of law for their security. Countries without these massive militaries. Countries like Germany, Netherlands, Sweden, Norway, Canada, Australia, Japan. Countries that need the rule of law. And this is what we have agreed to. Now, as Americans, when we agree to a treaty, it has to mean something. So I'm going, the moral issue, now the legal issue. Now, the legal background of this, the legal background is, well, the moral issue is interesting because it really begins, the whole venture begins in response to Hitler. It was the whole Manhattan Project came from a letter from Einstein saying the Nazis could develop E equals MC squared. Guess what? This means a weapon of horrific destructive capacity could be built, and the Nazis are trying to build it. And we better build one as a deterrent in the event they get one. And that's how the Manhattan Project began. That was the reason for it. And then, when the heavy water facility in Norway was blown up, Joseph Rotblat, this man I mentioned, this great hero, won the Nobel Peace Prize and could only get 15 minutes on Charlie Rose in our media in 1995. Won the Nobel Prize because he walked off and he said, there's no reason to build it anymore because the Nazis can't build it. But it had momentum, and we built it, and we used it. And then we thought, oh, we'll keep it, and no one else will get it. And then, of course, the Soviet Union got it. And they built 1,000, we built 1,011. They built 1,1200. We had to keep having more than them to make sure their first strike couldn't take out our arsenal. And before long, there were 60,000. Well, then the Cuban Missile Crisis came. And we came this close. We came this close to Armageddon. In fact, had Curtis LeMay had his way, and had we invaded Cuba, which he wanted to do, we wouldn't be here today. And you know the reason why is that the weapons were actually operational. The whole premise of the blockade was to prevent the weapons from becoming operational. Remember that? Remember duck and cover and everything? The whole reason, the fact is the CIA got it wrong. The weapons were operational. And Bob McNamara personally told me that he discovered that field commanders in Cuba had authority to launch, and had Curtis LeMay had his way and invaded, they would have launched and we wouldn't be here. And what got me started on this issue was I met Senator Kennedy, Bobby Kennedy. I was interning in Washington in the 60s, and he told us what happened. He told us how close we came, how we had the best foreign policy staff you could possibly have, and yet it was only good luck that saved us, in addition to excellent diplomacy, Ted Sorensen, thank God, and McNamara. So there was a wake-up call. So the intelligence community of the Soviet Union and the United States looked into this issue and said, came back to their respective leaders and said, if we don't do something, within a few decades, we'll have dozens of nuclear weapon states. By the 1970s, end of the 1970s, there'll be dozens of nuclear weapon states. So they began negotiating, discussing a treaty to stop the proliferation of the weapons. The treaty entered into force through the good efforts of Richard Nixon, who, by the way, also negotiated the Biological Weapons Convention. Republicans have done an enormous amount of good in this field. Ronald Reagan, of course, was the strongest abolitionist president, and George Bush Sr. negotiated the Chemical Weapons Convention, banning chemical weapons, as well as cutting the arsenal down to cutting it in half almost overnight, cutting it down to much lower numbers, strengthening the international system. So the treaty enters into force in 1990, and it's a clear bargain. 182 countries now in the treaty have agreed to not develop nuclear weapons. And the five nuclear weapon states in the treaty, the United States, Russia, China, France, and the United Kingdom, have agreed to two things. One, guaranteeing the peaceful uses of nuclear technology to the other countries in the treaty, countries that have renounced nuclear weapons. And two, negotiating their elimination. So some of the countries in 1970 didn't really trust us. I don't know why. And they said, we will not sign on to this treaty in perpetuity. It can't go on forever. We want the treaty reviewed after 25 years. And at that time, we will determine whether the treaty will be extended for another period of time or be extended indefinitely. So in 1995, all the parties to the treaty, at that time 187, came together in New York and they struck a bargain.
And the non-nuclear weapon states said, you know, we still don't trust you. If you want us to extend this treaty indefinitely, we need you to promise that every 5 years, your progress on disarmament will be reviewed. And we want you to be accountable to us. And we want you to tell us what you're going to do. And we want to review what you've done. And they laid out a series of principles and objectives as to how this would be done, that cuts should be irreversible, that the cuts should be transparent, that the value of nuclear weapons should be diminished, that we should make progress in ending testing anywhere for all time, that we should cut off the production of any more nuclear materials. And I can say that in 2000, at the first review, it was almost a celebration. There really was commitment. The United States was the first country to sign the Test Ban Treaty. We didn't get it through the Senate. You know, it got knocked down. But there was real commitment. And there were 13 practical steps agreed to in 2000. Each of these steps, making the world safer, reinforcing international cooperation, strengthening the rule of law. What were these steps? Cutting off the production of nuclear materials. They promised they would work on that. Bringing the Test Ban Treaty into force. Bringing the arsenals down to lower numbers. All of these things that make the whole world safer. And then we had a president who had a national security team who simply didn't believe in international law. I honestly don't know what they believed in. I really mean this seriously. I don't know what success looked like to them, and I don't understand their idea of America, because we had a guy, John Bolton, representing us, who said he didn't believe in international law. Now, I'm the co-chair of the American Bar Association's Blue Ribbon Task Force on Nuclear Nonproliferation. I'm on the governing board of the International Law Section of the ABA, so I have to have a little bit of knowledge of the U.S. Constitution. In fact, I won the New York International Film and Video Festival Silver Medal for a documentary I made on the Constitution in 1990. And I can tell you, you don't have to be a constitutional scholar to understand this. Article 6, Clause 2 of the U.S. Constitution is one of the checks and balances that our forefathers put into this extraordinary instrument. And it says that treaties that are ratified are the supreme law of the land. It's called the Supremacy Clause. And when we violate our own constitution, when we violate treaties that we've solemnly entered into, and when we flaunt them and say they don't mean anything, then I just don't understand, what does it mean to be an American? So in 2005, when the second five-year review of the treaty was to take place, the position of the United States was, we won't have our conduct reviewed. So that's it. We won't talk about it. We want to talk about the other guys. We want to talk about the dangers of proliferation. That's all we want to talk about. We want to talk about the problems of Iran and North Korea. Real problems. But how are you going to get the international community to talk about real problems when you don't live up to your own agreements? How are you going to tell your kids to stop smoking while you have a cigar in your mouth? How are you going to imagine if the Biological Weapons Convention said nobody can use smallpox and polio as a weapon? But 9 countries, because they're so responsible and so dignified, can use the plague as a weapon. Imagine if we said, which is in essence what we were saying, we will continue to flaunt our disarmament obligations, continue to say we have a right to these weapons of mass destruction, and tell everybody else they can't ever have them, and we will not have our conduct reviewed. That's what we did in 2005. And that set back the dignity of our country. That set back our security. That set back international law. That set back everything that we hold dear, in my opinion. And the press didn't report how serious this was. This was a serious lapse in judgment, as serious as invading a country based on a lie, to flaunt this treaty. So, in May of this year, the whole thing got turned around. And I'm proud to say that our president sent a wonderful team led by a woman, Susan Burke, who reported to a woman, Ellen Tauscher, who's our Undersecretary of State for Arms Control, who reported to a woman, Hillary Clinton, who's our Secretary of State. It's interesting that the United States is back in business of following the rule of law, back in business of working toward, to quote the president, the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons, back in business in working with the international community. And we recommitted ourselves to these steps. And the first one, of course, is that START treaty that Joe was talking about. And we reached a consensus that brought Iran and the United States together agreeing to a plan of action to make us all safer. I was in Iran last April at their conference that they had. And you know what? I want to report there are human beings there. And they don't want to die. They don't want their children to die. They do not want to kill us. In fact, the street signs in Tehran are in English and Farsi. And the government there doesn't want to die. And the government there doesn't want to live in a region filled with nuclear weapons. Because they have some problems, like the Pakistanis on their border that have nuclear weapons that are not one of the three countries not in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as you've heard, India, Pakistan, and Israel. And they have a problem. Israel has nuclear weapons. And they have a problem, which is some of the Sunni regimes in the region don't like them very much. And they have a problem. There are terrorists in the region. And they've had much, much, much more destruction than we've had from terrorism. And so they have some real problems, and they definitely don't want to see proliferation in their region. So we had an agreement. We have an agreement now in which 189 countries of the world have unanimously agreed to move forward. And darn it, that was not reported in the press. And I think that none of these things will be reported until there is a clarion call from people like us to say, we demand action on the disarmament agenda. And then our politicians are forced to deal with the issue. Then it becomes a legitimate issue. Then the press covers it. But I could understand why it's so hard to make it an issue. Because it is kind of hard to make it an issue. Because it's just terrible to think about. It really is. But you know, last year, $52 billion of our money was spent on this. You know, $52 billion. And in the current budget, the president, in order to move forward on the START treaty, has put in the budget, there's $180 billion extra to modernize the arsenal, to modernize the delivery systems. And the rest of the world looks at this and says, well, what is America about? Do they want to move toward a world without nuclear weapons? Or are they just gaming us? So we're at a crossroads. Because there are people who are nostalgic for the Cold War. They're just not gonna give up these weapons because their worldview is basically different than ours. Their worldview is that we can rely in perpetuity on the infallibility of machines and human beings to possess these weapons of massive annihilation and not have them used by accident or design in order to maintain our security. They say that's realism. Even though there have been hundreds of computer errors, hundreds of mistakes, planes that have crashed with the weapons, submarines that have smashed into each other in the middle of the Atlantic with nuclear weapons that have disappeared for a few hours, William Perry spoke at the UN last year and described how he was awakened because there was a satellite that had been recalibrated that saw its first sunrise and was unable to discern whether that sunrise was a full-scale launch. And that's what we're living with today. And we are subject to the command, control, and stability of the 300 seconds between Delhi and Lahore, should some computer hacker make it look like there's a launch there. Our well-being is subject to that. There is no place on the planet Earth where you can get away from this dilemma. And there are people who believe that we can continue this in the indefinite future to maintain peace and security. Now, I personally don't think that's realistic. I don't think that's realism. The Secretary General of the UN has said that's not realistic. The President of the United States has said that's not realistic. Ronald Reagan said it's absurd, it's absolutely insane and absurd to give anybody a 6-minute window of decision. 6 minutes in the event of a perceived launch. That's okay. 6 minutes from a perceived launch to decide whether to use them or lose them. And that's the situation that we're living with now, the situation that Ronald Reagan found so objectionable, that Ronald Reagan went to Reykjavik and tried to end, that he pledged with Mikhail Gorbachev to work for a nuclear weapons-free world. He wasn't with us long enough to accomplish that because he didn't think it was realistic. This past year, we had a conference at President Carter's, at the Carter Center, with about 25 countries. And President Carter told stories that were harrowing of how, of all of these instances, of how close we've come. The mayor of Nagasaki testified before the International Court of Justice. And I want to, and in this week, no one has talked about what happened. What happened? Just a little bit of the testimony. It's strong medicine. I know. And law is boring. I know. But you got to know, we made a legal commitment. Our country made a legal commitment to move toward abolition. The highest court in the world has said we have a duty to do this. The security establishment of Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, William Perry, Sam Nunn, Colin Powell, etc., are saying it's time. When Henry Kissinger says it's time, for goodness sake, it's time. The explosion of the atomic bomb generated an enormous fireball, 200 meters, and this is the mayor of Nagasaki, in radius, almost as though a small sun had appeared in the sky. The next instant, a ferocious blast and wave of heat assailed the ground with a thunderous roar. The surface temperature of the fireball was about 7,000 degrees centigrade, and the heat rays that reached the ground were over 3,000 degrees centigrade. The explosion instantly killed or injured people within a 2-kilometer radius of the hypocenter, leaving innumerable corpses charred like clumps of charcoal scattered in the ruins near the hypocenter. In some cases, not even a trace of the person's remains could be found. A wind over 680 miles an hour slapped down trees, demolished most buildings. Even iron-reinforced concrete structures were so badly damaged that they seemed to have been smashed by a giant hammer. The fierce flash of heat, meanwhile, melted glass and left metal objects contorted like strands of taffy, and the subsequent fires burned the ruins of the city to ashes. Nagasaki became a city of death, where not even the sound of insects could be heard. After a while, countless men, women, and children began to gather for a drink of water at the banks of the nearby Urakami River, their hair and clothing scorched and their burnt skin hanging off in sheets like rags. Begging for help, they died one after another in the water or in heaps in the banks. Then radiation began to take its toll, killing people like a scourge of death, expanding in concentric circles from the hypocenter. 4 months after the bombing, 74,000 people were dead, 75,000 had suffered injuries. That is, two-thirds of the city population had fallen victim to this calamity that came upon Nagasaki like a preview of the apocalypse. Like a preview of the apocalypse. Now, we are the first generation that has to consciously decide whether we will be the last generation. And this is what brings us together. In a strange way, humanity is now brought together because we are downwind from the conflict between India and Pakistan. If they start dropping these, we all suffer. We're part of one family now. If we are to protect the global commons, the oceans, the ozone, the climate, the living systems that we all depend upon, will we be able to ask countries to forsake short-term economic opportunity for long-term environmental responsibility while we threaten them with nuclear weapons? Will we get the kind of cooperation needed to address the fact that 70% of the fishing stocks are overfished? If one nation can dump in the oceans, everyone can dump in their flag. Will we be able to create, and we have to do this fast, in real time, an international system to protect the oceans that every country in the world has to sign on to? While a handful of countries say, we can persist with having nuclear weapons and you can't, in a nuclear apartheid world. I don't believe it is practical. It is immoral to contemplate the use. Their only value is to prevent them from being used, and that doctrine is contagious because other countries can all use the same doctrine. I don't believe we would want to use it on people. I don't believe we should accept it being threatened to be used against us. And I believe that in this moment in history, the admonition of the wise to treat others as you want to be treated, the universal golden rule, to treat other nations as we want to be treated, is the most practical way of getting the cooperation we need to protect the climate, to protect the oceans, and to protect our security. It's time that we realized that threatening to annihilate the sacred web of life in the interest of the state is no longer practical and certainly not moral. And it is my prayer that the same power that put this destructive capacity in something you can't see, touch, feel, or hear, it's mystical in a way, that the same power that placed this destructive capacity has placed in us, in a place you can't see, touch, feel, or hear, in our souls, in our conscience, in our love, in our passions, the wisdom and the courage to step forward and say, we've had enough. We believe we can live as one human family. We believe that it is time that the world eliminates nuclear weapons. We believe it is time that in the way our kids are living on these Blackberries, talking with everybody around the world, the admonition to see the world as one human family, that we step forward and say, it's time to move in that direction. Those are our family values. That is what we're about. Thank you very much. Oh, please, I'm sorry, questions on the left, on the right, mostly on the left, I hope.
Started on the right.
Yeah.
It's no secret this is an interfaith dialogue. And as we were talking about this morning, John, interfaith dialogue means two things. One is that we find common ground on which to have discourse, not only among ourselves, but with the society. And so Tyler was talking about natural law, and you've talked about a common element in all religions. The other side of authentic religious dialogue is that we don't abandon our own heritage. We don't abandon our own tradition, that we stay faithful to what we have historically believed. And I'd like to ask you to step inside at least one religious tradition and say what that would look like to respond to the issues you've put before us.
Yes. I actually have a footnote and a law review article on that. Buddhism, Hurt not others in ways that you yourself would find hurtful. Christianity, all things whatsoever you would that men should do to you, do you even so unto them. Confucianism, do not unto others what you would not have them do unto you. Hinduism, this is the sum of duty, do not unto others that which would cause you pain if done to you. Islam, no one of you is a believer until he wants for others that which he wants for himself. Jainism, in happiness and suffering, in joy and grief, we should regard all creatures as we regard our own self. Judaism, what is hateful to you, do not do to your fellow man. That is the law. All the rest is commentary. For me, that tradition, the tradition inside of every tradition, that says, love your neighbor as yourself. Honor the sacredness of life in others as you honor it within yourself. That's the place where I find my zone of faith. It is seeing the thread of grace that gives us all the ability to breathe, that makes every single life sacred and mysterious. And I see that in the admonition of Jesus in the second part of his instructions on how we find salvation. First, loving God with all your soul, all your heart, and all your might. And second, loving your neighbor as yourself. And clearly in today's world, neighborhood is a moral location, not a physical location. And our moral reach has to be coterminous with the reach of the effects of our actions. And the effects of our actions are now global. And therefore, our neighborhood is a global neighborhood. And if we are to take Jesus' admonition seriously, we have to see our neighbor as ourself, as the entirety of the human family. He doesn't say, treat believers as yourself. He doesn't say, treat the saved as yourself. He says, treat your neighbor. And the Good Samaritan is the example of how you treat your neighbor. So I think that's the ethical foundation. But I think the deeper foundation is found in the Quran, where God says, from a man and a woman I made the peoples amongst you that you would come to know one another. And the term of knowing is one of affection. And the best amongst you is the one with the most God consciousness, taqwa. And then God says, I alone am all aware and all knowing. And the external meaning is obviously interfaith, intercultural dialogue. Interfaith dialogue. But the inner meaning is, if God is all aware and all knowing, when you hurt another human being, you might be hurting that which is of God within them. That awareness, that life, that mystery of consciousness within them. That if I hurt you and you hurt me, we're hurting something sacred. And so those are just two religions that I see coming to the same point that Albert Schweitzer boiled down so eloquently. Reverence for life itself. Reverence for life. That's the ethical principle that I think is fundamental and universal.
Jonathan, thank you for your remarks. Joan and Jonathan, thank you for a great week. I want to acknowledge you for that. I want to pick up a note connected to what your chorus was on the human family and the human side of disarmament. We've heard this morning about the 8 or 9 states that have nuclear weapons, the 10 or 20 who are aspiring to it. I wanted to look at the 135 developing nations, the 45 least developed countries that are struggling with poverty, children completing school, women completing childbirth. Could you pull through, Jonathan, that thread of how disarmament and development come together and what we can learn on that topic? Thank you.
Absolutely. I want you to know Mr. Gardner is one of the intellectual resources of the United Nations. He works in the UNDP, United Nations Program for Development. And the United Nations Program for Development is the cutting-edge institution in fulfilling the Millennium Development Goals. And the Millennium Development Goals are a commitment that the United States and every other country in the world has made to address poverty, to basically end gross poverty on the planet, the kind of poverty where where half of the population is living on less than $2 a day, and a third of the human community doesn't have clean, potable water. Those are the real security issues. I mean, what's the function of the state? The function of the state is to make its citizens secure. So there are two issues that we can't neglect if we are to be secure. First is the global commons, the living systems we live, we depend upon, the oceans, the rainforest, the lungs, and the climate. The other is the idea that we could live in a stable world where half the world is unnecessarily, technologically, we have enough food to feed everybody. Technologically, we are able to provide water for everybody. So these Millennium Development Goals address what real security is, how human beings really live. And I don't think the cooperation needed to address that poverty can take place in a two-tiered security world. In order to fulfill the millennium, the option is this: either we have a cooperative effort to address global poverty, or we continue to have ad hoc negotiations, bilateral arrangements between the wealthy and the poor. And guess who usually loses in those negotiations? The poor. Consistently. In those negotiations, the rich always beat the poor. And any regime that has two sets of standards will intrinsically be unstable. Now, if all of these military expenditures brought security, if the 1.4 trillion that the world is spending on this, on military security now, actually brought security, I would be all for it. But as Oscar Arias, in a country that doesn't have a military, points out, unlike the other countries in Central America, they don't have a human rights problem in Costa Rica. They don't have a military. They have the highest education rate, the lowest infant mortality rate. And he points out that in most of the developing world, the militaries have actually been used to suppress the human rights in their own countries. And he convinced Panama to get rid of their military. And the difference, he went to Panama and Haiti when he was president. And he said, Panama took my advice, they're flourishing. Haiti didn't. They still have a military and human rights catastrophe. So I think that we need a new paradigm of security that says security is based on human beings, not based on weapons and states. How do people actually live? And that's just a totally different paradigm. But the whole world committed to it. This isn't just pie in the sky. This is a solemn commitment, the Millennium Development Goals. So I think that's the path. I think the commitment is there. I think the roadmap is there. And all I can say is I really honor the great work that you and your institution is doing. Thank you.
Your family is certainly unique, having suffered from two genocides, both ideologically driven. The Nazi genocide, choosing to select the Jews in particular, but also others, gypsies and other undesirables. And the genocide resulted, in the case of the Armenians, they were the undesirable other under the Muslim caliphate of the Turkish Empire. But while I agree with almost everything you said today, it's addressing last year's war, yesterday's war. It's all driven as a state problem. That's not our big problem today. Even Tehran is not crazy enough to commit suicide. They're Nazi, but they're not that Nazi. We have non-state enemies. Those non-state enemies are, in the present world, maybe different in the future, but in the present world, they are all Islamic. Well, there's been 15,000 attacks since 9/11. 15,000 that are all Muslim attacks on us, the non-Muslims.
I'm sorry, what is your question?
My question is, what are we doing to address the non-state problem?
Yes. Okay,
which
gotcha.
At the moment gotcha. Is bigger than the state problem.
Gotcha. First, let me address the simple mistake that you made, because it's just the media. In Sri Lanka, the first suicide bombers were Tamils.
Mm-hmm.
In India...
No, the first were the Japanese kamikaze pilots.
Well, those were state actors, I'm sorry. Well, you were talking about non-state actors in modern times. The first non-state actor modern terrorists were the Tamil Tigers. The kamikaze bombers were doing it in the name of a state. So that's a different... Do you follow the difference? You were the one that were pointing out.
I'm aware of the difference. The Tamil Tigers, that was a local... They were attacking people outside of Ceylon. That was an internal political problem.
No, the Hindutva that drives them are the same terrorists who killed Mahatma Gandhi. So you have fundamentalist terrorists and Naxalites, for example, in India, who are terrorists, who are killing, who are involved in thousands of people in India. Excuse me, let me, please give me the courtesy of answering.
Sure.
Who are terrorists, who are Hindu terrorists, and Hindu fundamental terrorists. Mm-hmm. So, and I could go on across the world. So the process of non-state actors and criminal syndicates and crazy people, in Japan you had a cult that did sarin gas in the subway system. No, madness and inhumanity are not monopolized by any group. So the first, that's the first point. The second point is, one of the reasons why we need to move toward a nuclear weapons-free world is the realization that nuclear weapons are obviously suicidal to use against a state with nuclear weapons. I'm quoting the Nobel Peace Laureate's Rome statement. They're suicidal to use against a state with nuclear weapons. They're patently immoral to use against a state that doesn't have nuclear weapons. And they're of no use against terrorists who can't be deterred. So what use are they? Of no use. And the way in which to ensure our security with respect to terrorists is to safeguard the nuclear materials. And that's precisely what the President of the United States did in March in bringing over 40 heads of state to Washington. This was an extraordinary event when he did it exactly for that reason. But to give you a perspective of what the reality is, the institution tasked with safeguarding the material, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has never spent more than $130 million in any year in doing the safeguarding for the whole world. $130 million in a whole year. Never more than that. And the system worked. It worked in Iraq. We did disarm Saddam Hussein, one of the few countries that tried to break out of the legal regime. It did work. The system is working. But think if it could work where you take the billions and billions that are continually spent. The United States spends about $150 million a day on our arsenal alone. And we spend less than $130 million a year in safeguarding the material. There's something wrong with this equation. We should be spending billions a day making sure the material doesn't get out. We've never lost an ounce of gold from Fort Knox. We know how to keep track of material. And gold doesn't leave a footprint. Radioactive material leaves a footprint. It's very dangerous. If I were a terrorist, I would put the material in a bale of marijuana. And I would import it into the United States. Because that's really easy. Yes?
My question has to do with two obstacles that I see and I'd like your opinion about. But I have to say first that I'm more optimistic after this week than I was before this week. Before this week, I was zero optimistic. And I've learned a lot, and I thank you. The two obstacles I see are, number one, President Eisenhower's military-industrial congressional complex. And that one has to do with we have to be at war, we have to be making weapons of any kind, or all of these large companies will go out of business, and they're the lobbyists. So that's one. The second obstacle is a country like Pakistan, where there is so much corruption, and it's true in our government too, but so you have people who will sell deadly drugs to make millions of dollars, even though they know it's killing people in the streets. They'll do that. Why not sell the materials to make an atom bomb if, or a hydrogen bomb if I can make money doing it. I think those are the two big obstacles that I can't figure out what to do about.
You're absolutely mark on. Those are the two adversaries that we have. And Pakistan had a physicist, A.Q. Khan, who had a black market in the materials and the technology.
Right, right.
And that's where Iran got their technology, where Libya got it. Mm-hmm. And they have just slapped him on the wrist, and he's not been punished very seriously, and it's a very serious problem. And the military-industrial media complex, since Westinghouse and GE own two of our big right. media, and as I was saying, all of these important issues that I was saying, because they're boring and not sexy, we should have the International Court of Justice, nuclear, the threat of nuclear weapons, and sex. I think we have the pornography of the trivial, and people don't know how much we're spending. The Brookings Institute did a study called Atomic Audit, and they concluded that we have spent $5.7 trillion. I can't get that high. With no public debate from 1946 to 1999 on the nuclear arsenal. 5.7 trillion, that's with no debate. That's real clout when you can get that kind of money for a venture. Yes, that's what we're up against. But you know, the good news is, the entire Southern Hemisphere is nuclear weapons free. And they're beautiful names. The Treaty of Rarotonga makes the South Pacific nuclear weapons free. The Treaty of Pelindabra makes Africa nuclear weapons free. And the Treaty of Tlatelolco makes Latin America nuclear weapons free. And in those countries, in the countries that we're talking about, they had military establishments that were persuaded not to go down this route. So it can be done.
I have one quick answer about that. Costa Rica, no military, right? If anything happens, they can contact us. We'll worry about it, right? What I'd like to see is the United States get rid of all military and let Canada worry about it. And we'll go to Canada.
Okay, yes.
Thank you. You mentioned this is a moral issue and a legal issue.
And a practical issue.
I think those are three good parameters. I remember in 1983 when the U.S. Catholic bishops wrote a peace pastoral
yes.
and addressed the morality issues, much of the same issues. It was inspiring. What I wonder is religions seem to get gripped by issues, whether they're human sexuality, abortion, even now a little bit the climate change. What will it take for this issue to become mainstream? To be focused on not just by good groups like yourself and others, but really mainstream where everybody gets into the discussion about it. What do you think it will take?
Well, let's start at Chautauqua. Let's make this an issue for Chautauqua. This is an institution that has the moral authority, the intelligence, the passion, the maturity of people, and now the educational foundation to have and lead a real discussion in the United States on what do we do? How do we create this? How do we get the platform, the kind of information that we've shared today? How do we get Joe Cirincione a larger platform? How do we get Sam Nunn a larger platform? Tyler Stevenson, these people really have something to say. Joan Campbell's got a lot to say on nuclear weapons. If it wasn't so hot, I might have been a little more energetic myself. There are voices. There are lots of really, really intelligent people, and we're just not getting the bandwidth. But a place like Chautauqua can really stimulate that. So there's going to be a movie coming out. I just did Deepak Chopra's radio show on Sunday, which has reached millions of people. I did it with Queen Noor, Valerie Plame. Remember the woman who got outed?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the CIA agent. Valerie Plame is on this. And Lawrence Bender, who did Inconvenient Truth and Pulp Fiction and Inglourious I said in the interview that there was no gratuitous sex and violence in the movie. And then Queen Noor said, yeah, but there's a lot of inglorious bastards. That was great. There's movies coming out, good. And it is time. How does a movement get traction? I don't know, but the National Council of Churches this year came out with a statement in support of it. The Conference of Mayors of the United States came out calling for a nuclear weapons convention. In other words, in the same way as there's a convention that George Bush Sr. led in negotiating eliminating chemical weapons, the mayors of the United States have called for a convention, a treaty eliminating nuclear weapons to be negotiated. Mm-hmm. There's a project, Mayors for Peace, that the mayor of Hiroshima started, now has 4,000 cities. Mm-hmm. My organization has a project called Parliamentarians for Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament. We're a global institution. We're now, with hardly any money, we've been able to, we just put the flagpole in the ground. We are in, we're in over 70 countries. We have over 800 parliamentarians. We have 15 ministers are in it. The Prime Minister of Australia, the new Prime Minister, one of our members. The Foreign Minister of Japan, one of our members. The Defense Minister of Norway. And all this is fairly new. And as I said, in May of this year, the countries of the world made that commitment. The political space is open for us. We'll make them short, Joan.
Hats off to you, Jonathan.
We can't have letters.
Thank you.
But I'll do them both at the same time.
At the same time, because we have to leave at 3:15.
Oh, okay. That's nice.
I think you just answered my question, Jonathan. Thank you, thank you, thank you for everything.
Thank you, Joan.
I am so fired up after this week. My question to you, after 3 decades, is there an optimism that there is a movement, that there is going to be a consciousness? Because psychic numbing, I've been in there for the past 20 years. I was like, oh, I'm not going to think about nukes. I can't do anything about it. But have you noticed a change in kind of like the consciousness of this issue?
Absolutely. When Deepak Chopra, who's really got his finger on the pulse and what people are willing to take in their hearts, when he starts grabbing the issue, when the Secretary General of the UN calls for a nuclear weapons convention, when the mayors call for it, you know, when Christy Brinkley joined my board, for goodness sake, you know, when you get that kind of momentum, I think it's time. Yes, this will be the last one.
Yes, thank you very much, Jonathan Granoff, for your wonderful and inspiring talk. Now, Helen Caldicott was warning people about the terrible dangers. I'm sure you know of Helen Caldicott.
Yes.
And one of her titles was, If You Love This Planet. The way that I would kind of put it, and maybe you will comment on this, if we love children, if we love our own children and our own children, our grandchildren, and the children of the world, I believe that all of us have a responsibility to act so that they can have a future. Would you be kind enough to comment on that? And I think we can do something about it from here.
I'll just end with a prayer. May the grace of God that has given us this glorious creation, given us the grace of community, the grace of family, the grace of our bodies, the grace of the moment of life in this world, give us the courage to speak truth, to know truth, give us the humility to place the sacredness of life itself before any pettiness that we might have. Give us the love of God and our fellow human beings to fill our hearts, and give us the doorways in which we can find ways of service to express the goodness in our hearts, and give us the blessing that we would stay within God's will to make this world a world of peace, a world of love, and a world of harmony. Amen.
And thank you to each of you who came out day after day to show us there is the possibility of a beginning of a movement right here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this lecture from the Chautauqua Institution. This lecture and hundreds of others are available for purchase at the Chautauqua Bookstore or online at ciweb.org or for download at thegreatlectureliberary.com.